We have a Professor Par Rawson who is joining us to talk to us a little bit about, you know, something that you might have been hearing in the headlines or maybe even on your social media feed recently. There's a lot of people who have been rallying together to bring awareness about what's going on in Cuba, saying with the hashtag SOS Cuba that they are needing support there in the country. You know, let's just start off with what has changed, Professor Rawson? Why are we seeing all of a sudden these people rallying for Cuba?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern for the well-being of the people of Cuba right now because of the, not to mention just the pandemic, but the economic recession they've had down there for a couple of years now has put a lot of pressure on them. Had shortages of food, high prices for food, lack of medicines, high prices for medicine if you can get it. So a lot of negative things have come together that largely were brought on by COVID-19 and the pandemic. Not to mention the loss of tourism dollars, the fact that remittances have been cut back. So a lot of things came together to put economic pressure on the people of Cuba.
How much of this had to do with the end of the Castro regime and the start of the new regime there?
I think that's probably coincidental. In my opinion, I think this is largely brought on by a culmination of essentially a failed economic system. We've seen it happen around the world. Lack of inputs to produce food products, lack of fertilizer, lack of capital for investment in food and agriculture. The fact that the government, that the Castros turned it over to a different set of people, I don't think that was a big factor. I think probably the pandemic had more to do with it than any single factor.
Hearing the rally cries from those within Cuba and across the world, largely also here in the United States, multiple cities where Cubans have been, asking for help, saying, listening to their message, they're saying how much these people are starving. And you mentioned, starving for resources on top of food. And tell me about the connection that Texas had with Cuba back in the 60s.
Well, it goes back to the well before the embargo, and Texas began to export meat, particularly beef, to Cuba back right after the Civil War, because we have 25 or 30 what were then called packeries, we now call them packing plants, along the Texas coast, and they largely served New Orleans. You could take a barge and go across to New Orleans, or you can put on another vessel, pack products like meat, and ship them down to Havana. So our meat trade with Cuba goes back a long, long way. And then in the pre and post World War II period, we began to export rice to Cuba. And I have personally been in Cuba, talked with people who remember eating Texas rice. And they'd really like to get it back. And so the ties go back a long way. I've been there 6 times now and had very, very positive interactions with people on the street, with the folks who run the businesses, with government officials who are looking to try and improve their agriculture, to try and bring products in. So it's been a very positive experience for me personally.
Do you know how much Texas lost out as far as money goes when they couldn't export the beef and rice to Cuba?
Well, we've done some work on that. We would estimate that in a really good year, Texas could probably export $200 million to $250 million in food products annually to Cuba. What would that be? That's difficult. I think for sure it's going to be rice. It's probably going to be some beef products, probably some chicken, some dairy products. We'll see some corn, grain sorghum, and some wheat. And then there's a whole host of processed foods that we have. In fact, I've been to Cuba with companies that were interested in exporting processed foods, and fact, helped one of them put on a food show there for sausages, frozen desserts. So it runs the gamut. The potential there really driven largely right now by tourism in a good year. But over time would be driven by the taste and preferences of the Cuban consumer, which I think rice and beans are the staple. But like most other developing countries, the Cuban diet will switch to a more high density protein product. And one of those first things will be meat products and beef in particular.
So when we talk about the money impact, you're saying that's how much we essentially lost back then. What is the potential if we were to improve those relationships?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If we could get things improved, we could stand to gain that $250 million annually. Okay. Exactly how much we lost in rice and beef sales is hard to estimate. Probably from rice alone, somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 million a year.
At the beginning of the last decade of the teens, things got a little better with Cuba as far as tourism goes.
Yes.
And were we allowed to send products to Cuba at that time, or was it just tourism?
No, it's been legal to export food products and medicines to Cuba since the year 2000. Congress passed the Trade Sanctions Reform and Export Enhancement Act that year, and Texas was at the forefront of that effort. In fact, the Texas Farm Bureau had the main agency representative in Texas in 1999 in anticipation of that change. And they toured him all around Texas, and he went to the upper Midwest, and I think he went to Louisiana and Arkansas and some other places. So we were leading that effort to get it open for business.
There's been rumors that there's some possible discussion with the current administration to improve that relationship. What do you know of those conversations?
Absolutely nothing. I don't know. Optimistically, I'd like to hope we're trying to make some inroads there, just from the standpoint of number one, helping the people, and number two, helping our Texas companies do more business.
What would you look at as a success?
Incremental gains. I think that'll have to happen. I don't think the Cuban government is going to just roll over and say, We give up, you know. I don't see that happen. By the same token, I don't think the United States is going to give in and say, well, you know, you still got people locked up, we think unjustly. They need to be turned loose, and if that doesn't happen, we're gonna hold the line, and we're not going to change things. So those things have to be worked through incrementally, diplomatically, to really begin to change the market. And I think one of the main changes would be to allow remittances to occur. There's a lot of Cuban Americans in the United States. They send just over $1 billion into Cuba annually when they can. So remittances are a big factor. Tourism could be big for the United States. Some of the work we did in the early 2000s indicated that it's another $1 billion market. And we were just starting to see the fruits of tourism opening when things were closed again in 2016, I guess, or 17, whenever that was. So all that went away. Tourism's huge there. In spite of the fact that Americans can't go as tourists, Canadians are the number one group of tourists. They represent about 40% of Cuba's tourism market in a normal year. They're largely a winter tourist groups that go down there. They fly directly into Varadero, which is the beach on the coast of Cuba that people love to go to. So a lot of potential in that area, and we have not been able to service much of that.
there anything else you think there's any, you know, myths or misconceptions or anything you'd like to clear up?
Well, when you, you know, we want to go in as much as I did over the length of time from 2003 to 2016 and the last trip, I've seen the changes that occur and the decline in infrastructure, road systems, buildings, bridges, those types of things, the port system. The contrast to that is the growth in the internet system. The first time I went, internet was terrible, almost non-existent. Email took forever. It was expensive. The last time I went, I had it in my hotel room, zip, 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 everything's done. You go outside at night and you look down the street, it looked like a giant firefly because the Cuban government had installed hotspots around Havana. People could bring their phones, their iPads, their computers out, stand around, get around those nodes, and it just lit up the whole city. So, you know, it's a like all developing countries, it's a land of contrasts. And I think it'll take time to work through that. The good news is that we can transfer technology today in a matter of hours that it used to take us years to transfer. Grocery checkout technology, for example, you can set that up in a few weeks in grocery stores so that you're scanning data, okay, and speed the throughput, increase the profitability of business, pay people more money to work in stores, et cetera. And it took us, what, 50 years to develop that in this country. So those kind of things are going to be monumental. It's just a matter of getting it started with investment.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.